Last time, we began a sub-series in our overall sermon series of dealing with, on the subject of dealing with grief, both whatever might be our grief, or whatever grief somebody else we know and love might be experiencing. This is the type of sermon as occasionally occurs in which you might tend to tune out because you don't think this applies to you. If you haven't experienced profound or significant grief in your life, hang in there, it'll happen. If you don't know anybody who has experienced it, then you're not paying attention. Grief is part of the universal human predicament, and it's not a happy subject to talk about, but it needs to occasionally be talked about. And so rather than doing a quick job on it, I'm trying to do a more complete job on it. And in our conversation, we're discussing the life of the Old Testament patriarch Job in the Old Testament book of Job. Chapter 1 tells us that on one fateful day, first, the Sabaeans sweep in and take away all of Job's oxen and donkeys and kill all of his servants watching them, except one who escapes and is able to tell him the disastrous news. And then again and again, bad news comes to Job. Secondly, in a different place, lightning strikes and kills all of Job's sheep and the servants watching them. Third, in a different location, the Chaldeans sweep in and steal all of Job's camels and kill all of the servants watching them. And then finally, in a fourth location, a mighty wind comes and collapses the house in which all of Job's sons and daughters are gathering to eat and feast together and kills all of them. And in the end, Job's wife gets mad at him and leaves him because she's not happy with the way he's processing his grief. In one day, in four tragic events, Job lost virtually everything and everyone that was important to him, and he entered into perhaps the most significant grief that any human being has ever experienced. And any one of us who has lost someone or something dear and precious to us, whether it's a dream or our health or a child or a parent or a spouse or a friend or failed at something or gone through a divorce, whatever it is, whatever the loss is, while it might not be as intense in our experience as Job's grief was, it's the same type of grief, the same feeling, and it manifests itself in the same hurt and the same sense of angst and agony. By definition, grief is a life-shaking sense of sorrow arising from some great loss, and a profound sense of grief arises from a profound sense of loss. Grief can arise, as I've already said, from a whole variety of different kinds of losses and not just death. Different people handle grief differently, and some of those ways aren't necessarily helpful or healthy. Grief can lead to a whole variety of other painful feelings and manifest itself in a whole variety of hurtful reactions. Grief strikes children just as much as it strikes adults. And in fact, because children frequently don't have the rational ability to process their way through grief, it sometimes strikes them more powerfully than it does adults. But grief tends to manifest itself in six fairly identifiable stages or patterns or reactions. Now, these aren't gospel. Not everybody feels these things. Not everybody feels them all in the same way, in the same order. Some people skip some of them. Some of them blend together. But it's helpful to kind of think in terms of what the reactions are that we experience and people we care about experience in loss and grief. Number one might be called numbed shock. This is the "I cannot believe this has just happened to me" reaction. In our passage, which we read last week, Job had three friends who came and saw him, and at the end, they saw how great was his suffering. Shock is our bodies and our spirits' initial reaction to some form of trauma that overtakes us. In its most intense form, shock can kind of deny that there's anything wrong. In its mildest form, shock can kind of wonder, well, why didn't this hit me any more than it has hit me? But in all cases, when we go through a profound loss, there is this change in feeling that manifests itself in a change, at least temporarily, of behavior. Now, as I mentioned, Job had three friends. Now, if what they had done is come and said, "We are so sorry, Job. We love you so much. And gave him a hug, didn't offer platitudes or ask too difficult of questions. They helped him clean up the mess that was left behind and then left. Man, it would have been fantastic and a perfect example of how the rest of us could handle it in all of our difficulties. Unfortunately, what they did, as the book tells us, is they lectured him for 34 chapters in a 42-chapter book, and now they are the example of how not to handle somebody else's grief instead. Number two, stage might be considered utter despair. This is the, oh no, what am I going to do now? I have no idea how to pick up the pieces. My life has caved in on me. How am I going to possibly deal with this reaction? The very last verses there, verse 11. Why did I not perish at birth and die when I came from the womb? You know, when somebody is utterly despairing, sometimes that's when they think about suicide. Or even if they're not actually contemplating suicide, they think to themselves, you know, to be honest, my life doesn't matter. Nothing's going to ever get better. I'd probably be better off if I didn't exist anymore. They would never consider killing themselves, but they have this powerful sense that all the value in life is now gone. Verse 25, I have no peace, no quietness, no rest, but only feel turmoil inside. Let me read you this description of author Lynn Cain in a book about the despair she went through. After the protective fog of numbness had finally dissipated, then life became truly terrifying. I was full of grief, choked with unshed tears, overwhelmed by the responsibility of bringing up two children alone, panicked about my financial situation, almost immobilized by the stomach-wrenching pain of realizing I was alone, and my psychic pain was such that even utterly routine household chores loomed like Herculean labors before me. And what do you think her loss was? Grief, bringing up two children alone, panicked about my financial situation, realizing I was alone. It wasn't death. This is in a book called Divorce. Look, I want to tell you again, the same feelings occur in any kind of profound loss or crisis. It isn't just death. And if we're sensitive friends and compassionate friends, we realize that if somebody has flunked out of school, if somebody has failed in business, if somebody has a boyfriend or a girlfriend that they had committed themselves to that breaks their heart, and any number of other things, they go through some version of this, and our reaction to them needs to be the same. Typically, if the grieving person is well connected, by the way, sympathy will flow like a river over them, especially after death. People will show up, and to be honest, it becomes at times a bit of a burden. I just need to be alone. So we overwhelm them when maybe they need to be alone, and then 1 month, 2 months, 6 months later, when they more than any other time in their grief process need people to remember both them and remember what they have lost, we tend to kind of drift off because we've moved on and we've forgotten what they can never forget, either their failure or their loss. It's important to remember that when people go through grief and loss, it lasts a whole lot longer for them than it lasts for us. And by the way, evening is the most difficult time for anybody to deal with any kind of struggle because it's dark. And if you're alone, it's far more difficult. In fact, this is absolutely the worst time of year. When it's cold, when it gets dark at 5:30, you're done with work and it's dark. That's when depression and despair hit the most. And that's when our interaction with people sometimes is the most helpful. It's important to continue listening patiently to people. Some people will talk endlessly about their loss, and that's how they cope with it, and that's what they need from us. They don't need us to lecture them. It's important to ask questions, but to not give them too much unsolicited and certainly unhelpful advice. And it's important to remember that we need to allow our friends and loved ones to cry, especially men, and to cry with them. If you are crying in a sense of hurt, and you look up and see somebody kind of doing this, it's not nearly as helpful as if you look up and see the person sympathizing with you and empathizing with you. I'm not saying fake it. I'm just saying it's crucial that other people know that we hurt for them. If they feel like we're outside of their hurt or above their hurt or unconcerned about their hurt, it's not helpful. But if people have a sense that we really empathize with them because we love them and we have compassion for them, it makes such a difference in terms of how we can help them cope. I love the story of the little girl whose best friend had died 6 months earlier, and so she went to visit the still grieving mother to kind of get into the room and into the house. And she tells her parents about it at dinner, and her father says, "What in the world did you say to her?" And the little girl said, "I didn't say anything. I just climbed up in her lap and helped her cry." Now, we can't do this as adults, but we can do something very similar to this for our friends. Number three, and here we begin anew. What might be called reliving the past. This is the life will never be this good again. I'll never be this fortunate again. I will never be this happy again. Job says, "How I long for the months gone by, for the days when God watched over me, when his lamp shone upon my head and his light, and in by his light I walked through darkness. Oh, for the days when I was in my prime, when God's intimate friendship blessed my house, when the Almighty was still with me." And the point here is that there's a sense that God isn't with me anymore. Because if God really cared about me, he wouldn't have let this happen to me. "And my children were around me when my path was drenched with cream and the rock poured out streams of olive oil." That's not my personal vision of happiness, but apparently it's his. Ah, the good old days. You know how that is? When you get above a certain age and you can't help think about how much better things were, how much happier I was, or how much simpler things were in the past. And Job lost so much, only the past looked good to him. And when we begin to think about the past, we tend to have one of two reactions. Either, number one, we idealize it. My grandfather is a far better grandfather now that he's dead than he ever was when he was alive. He was not a bad grandfather. He was kind of non-existent grandfather. So what my brain has done is it only remembers the really positive things, and I have a short list of really positive things about my grandfather, and I think, what a great guy. My dad will be a much better father after he dies than he is when he's alive, and my dad is a fantastic father now, but I assure you he will be better after he has passed on. My dad wrote a book about my mother after she died. It actually drives his sons crazy because he's consumed with writing the story of my mother's life. And we kind of say, she wasn't quite that good. She was good, but she wasn't that good. I mean, she was wonderful, but she wasn't perfect. And my dad, as part of his still 10 years later, his coping mechanism is he has idealized my mother. Praise God. I'm happy for him. I hope I will be a better person after I've died. I had a coworker several years ago who was convinced she would never, ever be able to find another man who could possibly be as good as her husband. Now, what that means in reality is I'll never find somebody I love as much or relate to as well or have the same history with. It's not honestly that there's no other really good guy out there, but that's the thought process we go through. In fact, I once said to her, I said, did your husband walk on water? And she said, why do you say it? Because I get the impression he was really that kind of a guy. She just idolized him. The second reaction we tend to have sometimes when we relive the past is we are racked with guilt. We live in a whole litany of I should've's or a lifetime's worth of if only's. You know, if only I had paid more attention to the warning signs. I would have relaxed more. If only I'd set more money aside. If only I'd learned how to manage credit cards and wasn't in such financial distress right now. If only I'd focused on my true priorities and I wouldn't be in the place I am right now. If only I'd known my mother was going to die or my husband was going to die prematurely, then I would have devoted more time and energy to the relationship. If only I hadn't waited too long to ask for forgiveness or extend forgiveness or to reach out to the person or to seek healing or to restore the relationship, and now I can't. If only I'd known my health was going to decline right after retirement and all my plans were going to go out the window. If only I'd spent more time enjoying the present rather than dreaming about what the future would be. If only, if only. It's natural to feel guilty when someone or something is unexpectedly lost and we wish we could turn back the clock and rearrange our priorities. You can't. There is finality in death. And by the way, part of the lesson is don't keep saying, I will eventually, or there's still time, because there's no guarantee that there's time, not just in relationships, but anything else in life. But in circumstances where perhaps guilt is justified and we should feel remorse for how we handled things or didn't handle things, it is crucial to know that forgiveness is final as well. Do you believe that there is nothing in life that God doesn't and has forgiven you for? Just as final as death is, God's forgiveness is just that final. He doesn't give it and take it away. It's not temporary. It's final. Number four, what might be called angry resentment. And sometimes this happens earlier. This is so unfair, is the thought process. Job says, God, you throw me into the mud. I am reduced to dust and ashes. I cry out to you, O God, but you do not answer. I stand up, but you merely look at me. You turn on me ruthlessly. With the might of your hand, you attack me. You snatch me up and drive me before the wind. You toss me about in the storm. I know you bring me down to death, to the place appointed for all the living. He's angry at God for how God has treated him or perceives has treated him. He rails against God's injustice and life's unfairness. Why did you do this to me? And that's the key. God, you're at fault here, and you did this to me. Have you noticed that it doesn't bother as much what we think God does to other people as it bothers us that he does it to us? Why is that? You know, if we have something that's lost or a relationship that falls apart, we tend to blame other people. But when someone dies, we blame God. And the good news is that God's got big shoulders, he doesn't get his feelings hurt, he doesn't get mad at us, and he can cope with whatever feelings we throw him. When somebody is angry, it's important that we listen patiently and not absorb the anger personally and let them express what they're dealing with. Now, if they're completely brutal in their handling of it and they're directing it towards us, then it's appropriate to quietly get up and go. You don't have to be abused. But frequently when somebody is angry, especially when they're angry with God, it's not always the appropriate thing to do is to say, well, you shouldn't feel that way. By the way, you shouldn't feel that way is the last thing you should ever say to somebody. Because they feel that way, whether they should feel that way or not. The first question, why did this happen, is actually relatively easy to answer. God created human beings to have a loving relationship with him. And in order to have a loving relationship, he had to give us freedom of choice. We can't express love or experience love unless there is a freedom to reject the object of love. So God has to say, you can either love me or not love me. And because the first human beings chose themselves rather than God, a broken humanity exists in a broken world. And because we exist in a broken world, there are famines and there are droughts and there are tornadoes and hurricanes. There is disease and cancer and accidents. And because there are other fallen human beings around us, they can use their freedom of choice to decide to do things that hurt you. You know, the big example could be Hitler, who chose to wipe out millions of people, or it could be somebody who chooses to drink and drive and hits your child on a Friday night. But the second question, why did this happen to me, there is no really good answer for. So if you hear somebody say, why did God do this to me? The best thing you can do frequently is sympathize, because there is no philosophical argument that's going to help a person deal with what they think is completely unfair in life. But here's the key. Hebrews chapter 11 talks about faith. But faith isn't something that we exercise up until the moment of loss, where we're still negotiating and bargaining with God and thinking maybe we can work our way out of it and trust God will fix all of our problems for us. Faith is what happens after the person has died, after you flunked the test, after you failed in the relationship or in business, and then you still trust that God can help you pick up the pieces and move forward. Number five, a new perspective. The Lord answered Job. After all of these chapters of Job's friend telling him what's wrong with him and Job telling God what's wrong with God, the Lord answered Job, "Who is this who darkens my counsel with words without knowledge? Brace yourself like a man, and I will question you, and you shall answer me. Where were you when I laid the foundations of the earth? Tell me if you understood. Who marked off its dimensions? Surely you know, if you know so much to accuse me. Have you ever given orders to the morning or shown the dawn its place? Have you comprehended the vast expanses of the earth? Tell me if you know all of this. Do you know the laws of heaven? Who endowed the heart with wisdom or give understanding to the mind? Who has a claim against me that I must pay? Everything under heaven belongs to me. Would you discredit my justice? Would you condemn me to justify yourself? Will the one who contends with the Almighty dare to correct him?" You know, the truth of the matter is God doesn't slap us down when we need it. It'd be nice if sometimes God would speak and say, "Just shut up. You have no idea what you're talking about. I'm sick and tired of your self-pity and your whining." Well, sure, life is unfair. Everything I do is fair because by definition I'm God, and God only does just things and only does fair things. And you're evaluating things purely from a human standpoint, and a human standpoint isn't correct. Wouldn't that be nice if sometime God would do that? Well, maybe not, but it would be helpful. For two chapters, God takes Job through a crash course in Theology 101. Job, you've forgotten the basics. I'm God, you're not. Everything I do is good and right. You not so much. I didn't cause your problems, so stop blaming me. These things happen to fallen people in a fallen world, but I'm here. I'm still in control. I'm still sitting on the throne, and I'm waiting for you to come to me so that we can pick up the pieces of your broken life and put it back together, make meaning and sense out of it. I love you. I forgive you, and I will embrace you and support you in every way possible. Well, we like that in theory, but first, we're so angry. We're so hurt. We're so disappointed, and we have to turn the corner. God's primary purpose in his relationship with us. Try the next one. Next one. God's primary purpose in his relationship with us is not to protect us from pain or shield us from suffering, but rather to conform us to the character of Christ. Now, most of us can pay lip service to this. God's point in life is to make us become more like Jesus. But how does God do that? Only through happy things? What causes us to develop faith more? What causes us to become more Christ-like? It's dealing with difficult circumstances and disappointments and losses. It's not just always rejoicing that everything is good and wonderful. God wants us to be conformed, but at the same time, God wants us to be comforted. God isn't just about, okay, you're going to go through hurt so that you become like Jesus. I'm going to love on you and comfort you in this process. In fact, go to the next one. And 2 Corinthians 1 is this verse that all of you should know, that God comforts us in all of our sorrows so that we can comfort others in sorrow with the comfort we ourselves have received from God. Have you ever had that experience? I have gone through hurt that I remember in the past and loss that I remember in the past, and I can empathize with how this person feels, and I'm going to reach out to them and encourage them and embrace them because I know how necessary it is because I recognize that God or others have done this for me as well. God uses us as his mouth to speak words of encouragement and affirmation. God uses us as his arms to embrace and to console other people. In fact, it isn't possible for a person just to philosophically, from belief in God, to receive all the comfort they need. They need us, and they need us not just a day after it happens. They need us months, usually years after it happens, if only to relive the joy before the loss. Job slowly begins to turn. He slowly begins to think about things from a different perspective, that life isn't out of control, that God is still in control, that God didn't cause the problem, but God's there to help, love on him, and encourage him in the problem. And number six, what might be called a new beginning. This is my favorite part of the whole book. It's like you get two chapters of the setup of the problem and the painful experience of, oh my gosh, Job, nothing could be worse. And then you get chapter after chapter of his friends going, if you'd only, or what the heck did you do to cause this? And then you get a couple of chapters of Job defending himself. I didn't do anything wrong. It's all you, God. And then a couple of chapters of God slapping him down and going, dude, that's not the way it is. And finally, at the very end, we get this. Then Job replied to the Lord, I know that you can do all things, and no plan of yours can be thwarted. You asked, who is this who obscures my counsel without knowledge? Surely I spoke of things I did not understand, things too wonderful for me to know. I am now ready to face the future, confident that you are in control and can be trusted. Previously, my ears had only heard of you, but now my eyes have seen you as you really are. You know, it's in the crucible of testing and suffering and pain that we recognize what we actually believe or don't believe. It's when our faith is tested and we decide if our faith is real or just verbiage. It's when we discern, what do we actually believe about God? Is God the God that with our own creation, or is he the God of the Bible and of reality? By the way, Barbara, I mentioned 2 weeks ago in her book, Stick a Geranium in Your Hat, Barbara Johnson, who's got, it's her least humorous book, but she summarizes everything that we've just talked about in these words. We churn, we burn, we yearn, we learn, and then we turn. This is in your handout, but we churn with anxiety and a whole number of feelings and losses and reactions initially. We burn with anger and resentment. How could this possibly happen to me? We yearn for the past and all the peace and the good things that we thought were in the past. And eventually we learn that God is ultimately in control and has a plan. And finally, we turn the problem over to God in faith and receive what God has to offer us. By the way, God intends our loss and our grief to be a tunnel, not a cave. A cave is something that has no back, that's completely dark, and you go in there and you're stuck. A tunnel is something that when you first get in, man, it looks like a cave. It feels like a cave. It's as dark as a cave. But if we trust God to lead us through it, we eventually get to the light and get to the other side. God intends for grief to be a process for us, that we move from initial darkness to the light on the other side, not a cave where we sit down and bow our heads and give up. However, it's okay to get into the tunnel and sit down and bow your heads and give up for a while, but then you got to get up and move to the other side. Okay, that's enough. Listen, I know that this is not a happy, slappy message. Some of you still have grief very real because either recently or not a long time enough ago, you have experienced a loss, whether it's a relationship or a loved one or health issues or whatever it is. As Christians, we cannot expect that God's going to solve all of our problems, and he certainly doesn't eliminate all pain and suffering in our lives. But God allows us to make sense and find purpose in the suffering that he doesn't cause, but that he uses us to become more and more like Jesus. Now, does that sound good to you? Does that sound worthwhile to you? If you were to redefine your Christian life, would it be, God, eliminate everything negative. I don't want to lose anything. I don't want to ever hurt. I don't want to ever be in pain. I want everything to always be happy and good. Well, unfortunately, if that's what you want, that's not what you signed up for. You signed up for a God who will love you in all circumstances, who will forgive anything and everything forever, who cares more than you can possibly know. In fact, he died on a cross to demonstrate his willingness to give and give and give sacrificially for you, who is always there, who is always present, who has provided other people who will love you and care for you imperfectly, but still love you and care for you as you and God pick up the pieces and move forward. Please join me in prayer. You know, Father, in our heart of hearts, we don't ever want to be unhappy. We don't ever want to hurt, and we don't ever want to suffer. And we understand intellectually the positive value of it, but if we were honest with ourselves, we'd say, remove it all, and then I would be happy. And we would be happy people with no character and no faith. Prevent us from ever really thinking that way, Lord. And in our losses, help us to turn not from you, but to you. Help us to not blame you, but to trust you. And help us to have friends that will love on us, and for us to be the kind of friend that will love on others as well. We love you so much, God. Thank you for loving us. In Jesus' name, amen.